The king is dead. Long live the king. A few short years ago, we had but a few big brands of beer from which to select. Today, we can select from thousands of international, national, regional, local, and even homebrewed beers. All these possibilities lead us to ask, do we really want or need a king of beers?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 994th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Vancouver, BC, who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Aaron.
Yes.
Hey, do you think we really need a king of beers?
I think it's debatable.
Okay, good enough. Folks, throughout most of human history, beer was our liquid bread. It was how we preserved our grain and how we purified our water. In fact, beer provided us the energy to pitch camp and build civilization. After World War II, the industry of beer consolidated into a few major brands that dominated the grocer's shelves. If we wanted to enjoy a beer, we had to enjoy one of those beers. And thus there came to be a king of beers. But then beer drinkers rediscovered a very elemental fact. Beer is easy to brew. Today, we can select from international, national, regional, local, and even homebrew beers. And the number of possibilities from which to select is growing rapidly. According to the Brewers Association, there are now 4,500 commercial brewers in the United States, and new ones are opening at the rate of 1.5 a day. All this selection leads us to ask, do we really want or need a king of beers? Well, here to help us answer that question, brew up some answers as it were, we have Emily Slayton Loftus, who is the author of Sustaining Home Brewing. Now, sustainable home brewing. Welcome to the Food Chain, Emily.
Thank you. It's great being here.
So, what was that epiphany moment when you decided that you had to write a book about sustainable home brewing?
It's something that had been in the back of my mind for many years. I was started home brewing in 1994 and was involved in the home brewing business from 1997 to 2011, which is when I started writing the book in 2011. So it's something I always wanted to do but never had the time until I actually left full-time employment in the homebrewing business, because writing books took a lot of time.
So I think you're going to try to talk us into brewing our own today, right?
Well, I won't try to talk you into it, but if you're interested in it, I definitely will try to encourage you.
Do you think we need...
Not for everybody, but for those it's for, it's a great...
It's a great fun. Do you think we need a king of beers?
I don't think we need them. Some people may want them. It's a choice that each person has to make. But I fully welcome the diversity in the beer and wine world that we're seeing now.
Also with us today, we have John Benedetti, Santa Arca. You pronounce it. I'll blow it.
Santa Arcangeli Family Wines and former owner and co-founder of Santa Adarius Rustic Ales.
Good to go. And I know John very well because I am on a board of Think Local First County of Santa Cruz with him. And whenever we have a board meeting, we all get together and enjoy home cooking, of course. But we also enjoy homemade wine, homemade beers. So much fun that when we started thinking about doing this radio program on homemade brewing, I thought, gosh, got to have John sit in on this as well. Your a specialty now is wine.
Yeah, I segued. I was a longtime home brewer, 20-plus years, started when I was 19. Wow. But I segued to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in 2008, kind of started a brewery midstream there and then diverted back to wine.
So you're a manufacturer of both?
Well, I was a manufacturer of beer briefly, but now, yeah, we produce about 1,000 to 1,200 cases a year of locally grown Pinot Noir and Chardonnay now.
Which do you find most fun? Brewing wine, brewing beer, or fermenting wine?
I like the winemaking because I feel a little bit more connected to the seasons and to the land. You know, I'm in the vineyard a lot. And beer, awesome to drink and brew on a small scale, is quite the industrial grind when you're brewing it, even for a small community brewery. So for me, winemaking is definitely
so something that has intriguing. Its seasons, whereas beer you can brew just about any time.
There are seasonal beers, especially I have an affinity for fresh hop IPAs, pale ales, which, you know, you can grow hops in your backyard and or on, like Coralitos Brewing does, on some commercial property in Coralitos, and brew a really nice fresh beer from that.
And that's one of the things that really strikes me about homebrew beers or local craft beers is the incredible diversity and tastes and character. That's, I guess, what makes it so much fun. You never know what you're going to find, but it always seems to be pretty interesting. I'd like to take a moment to go way back in time, because our experience with beer and wine does go way back in time. We'll start with you, Emily, Amelia. Way back to the time of the Egyptians is where we first see evidence of beer making, right?
That's correct. Most historians agree that's when beer first made it onto the radar, at least. And that was also a time when civilization was starting to work with leavened bread. And so it's, you know, the theory is that some bread was left out where it got rained on or something like that and let to sit for a while, and then they came back and tried it, and it was good.
And it was good, and it kind of made you feel a little bit silly. How take us back to then. How did we make beer way back then?
Actually, it was, from my understanding, they basically broke up bread and added water, and so the yeast was already in the bread. And probably then they didn't have the high heat ovens we have now that would these days probably kill all of the yeast. But then there was enough live yeast in there to do the fermentation.
Wow. So just take some bread that has yeast in it from the air, right? It's just natural yeast floating about. Put the bread in the water and pretty soon you have beer. Simple as that.
That's the theory. I don't think they, you know, exactly know for sure, because we're just unearthing clay pots with beer residue on it and just trying to take some educated guesses.
What do we do that's different now?
It's a multi-stage process where the primary grain, which is usually barley, is sprouted in a malting process and then dried so that it lasts for a long time, and it's dried at a precise moment so there's still live enzymes in the grain. When that's reintroduced to hot water, those enzymes act on the starches in the grain and convert them to fermentable sugars. That's a process known as mashing. And then that liquid is collected, strained out of the grains, collected and boiled with flavor ingredients,
like usually hops.
Mm-hmm. But there can be others. And then and from, yeast is
from,
introduced.
From reading Sustainable Home Brewing, there can be a lot of others right now.
Exactly.
So thus you can do just about anything to your beers. But essentially, same process.
Right.
As throwing bread in a glass of water or a pot of water, and pretty soon you get beer.
That's right.
Well, John Benedetti, what about wine?
Well,
take us back to the beginnings of wine. How did they go about making wine back then?
Wine really hasn't changed at all in, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years. A lot of wineries nowadays are going back to the old methods, native yeast fermentations, minimal input from the winemaker. I'm pretty sure that wine started from some farmer who left some grapes in a bucket that he picked and just forgot about them. And then a couple of days later, he came back and had the guts to dip a ladle in there and taste it.
And there it was.
There it was.
And how do we do things differently these days?
Well, it depends on the size and scale of the winery, really. Mm-hmm. We have large and small. I mean, larger wineries who can't pay as close attention to detail have to use product to correct their wines, and small wineries can kind of stick to the old ways and intervene only when absolutely necessary.
Okay, folks, there you go. We're talking beer, we're talking wine here on the Food Chain, because it is the staff of life in liquid form, right? If you have any questions today, we invite you to participate. We have Amelia Loftus, and we have John Benedetti, and we have beer and wine. Anything you want to know about growing your own, manufacturing your own beer and wine, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about beer and wine, but we're not talking about those big boys like the King of Beers. And the funny thing is that we were considering doing this radio show with Amelia Loftus, who came out with a book called Sustainable Home Brewing. And I was really fascinated with the notion of taking charge of our own beer, I guess, as it were. And as I was considering the show, I picked up an article in the Wall Street Journal, and the title of it was Bud Crowded Out by Craft Beer Craze. Mm-hmm. Story of a gal in North Carolina who has a bar. She has 69 different spouts of beer coming out of the wall, and only one of them is Budweiser, and she's going to get rid of that. And I got to thinking, it really is a sea change in the way we're thinking about how we eat and what we drink, and I guess sustainable home brewing and craft brewing is a very good indication of that change, where there was a few beers like Budweiser. Budweiser was purchased from the Bush family a few years ago by the InBev Corporation. I think it's of Brazil or something, a big giant multinational. And now it's no longer even a family brewery. It's a giant multi-level multinational corporation. And all of a sudden, all of these local craft beers are springing up all over the country. I think in our little town here, there's must be a half a dozen breweries all of a sudden. Why is that we become so fascinated with drinking local again? Amelia, let's start with you.
I think the primary reason is flavor. People have discovered that beer has a wide variety of flavors available, just using natural ingredients, using a wider range than just barley, malt, and hops, and beer brewed, you know, on a slower, smaller scale, has a lot more flavor from different yeast varieties and just the attention to craft and detail that smaller breweries can bring to it just makes the beverage a whole different experience than opening a can of Bud. And people have really gotten to like that.
Not quite so convenient, though, right, John?
Well, convenience, you know, to a beer geek is not really all that important. Quality and community are really the things there. And, you know, local communities and local breweries are really producing some extremely high quality products that foster a really fun and interesting community of people who seek those sometimes hard to find spots out to go and be a part of the experience.
I guess one of my great fears in life is, you know, going on a great adventure, traveling someplace to some exotic place in the world and ending up drinking Budweiser, you know, or eating McDonald's or something like that. And I guess what you're saying about community is that beer is really a way of expressing community, of who we are.
Beer, the brewery scene and the beer scene is a huge expression of a community, in some communities to a greater extent than others. Santa Cruz is sort of a budding area in that budding town in that realm. You have towns in, you know, like Portland and Bend and Oregon and, you know, others like
San
Diego.
My hometown of Billings, Montana is developing quite a beer scene too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then I guess when you do develop those local breweries, those local craft breweries, you're really developing as well your sense of community too. That works both ways, does it not, Amelia?
Yes, definitely. Even starting from the very basic home brew level where, you know, when you first brew a batch of beer, you don't want to just sit in a box and drink it yourself. You want to share it with people, and then you start to find other people who are interested in brewing beer too, and the next thing you know, you have, you know, an impromptu club or just, you know, a group of like-minded people that are fascinated with the process of making beer and want to explore that with their friends and neighbors.
End up becoming foodies of beer, as it were.
Indeed.
You know, we were talking before the show a little bit about our history with alcohol and the things that we ferment and brew into our liquid foods, as it were. And that history goes way, way, way back in time, thousands of years. And thinking of how our bodies and have developed the genetic intelligence to live with alcohol, as it were, through that course of time. Amelia?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up because I've actually just gone through a nutrition course of all things and, you know, learned there are specific enzymes that actually act on alcohol to break it down and extract energy from it, just like other foods. And it's also interesting that, you know, different cultures have evolved more of this and other peoples don't have as much of it. So you hear stories about people mm-hmm. who can't handle their alcohol. Well, there's a physiological basis to that. And also it's good to note that, you know, even those of us who are evolved to ingest and digest alcohol up to a point, when we go exceed a level, the alcohol has to be processed in different pathways, which are not healthy. So,
which is what gets us into trouble then.
Right.
Well, there you go. Well, do you think that intelligence that our bodies have developed over the years has given us a desire for finding different tastes in alcohol, different expressions of it then?
I think it kind of mirrors our desire to try different foods, you know, and experience different foods. It's, I think having a healthy physiology means you have to have a diverse diet and, you know, to get all the different hundreds of vitamins and micronutrients that you need, you know, looking for variety is a good thing. And
so there is an intrinsic need for us to find variety. Just by virtue of the all of the different elements our body needs
right.
to be healthy, then
right.
The best beers and wines are really built for food. I mean, it's part of the experience of the meal. It's not a standalone item, as nor is your meal. I mean, the pairing is really kind of what it's about.
It seems like they go together, doesn't it? You know, if you have a great meal, you need to have the cuisine and you need to have the drinks, and they go together so well.
That's right.
Make the experience. Well, I'd like to, if possible, examine what happened to the beer industry, because it seems like kind of right after World War II, there was a great consolidation in the beer industry, and, you know, just a few giant breweries came to dominate the entire scene. I remember, you know, being in the Navy and having the occasion to go through a Budweiser plant in L.A., and, you know, I've marveled at the industriousness of it, but there seems to be something missing with respect to desire to drink the beer. It didn't seem to sell me, as it were. And in that regard, you know, the whole notion that we would only have a few different beers from which to select when we go to the store always seemed to be kind of a depressing thought to me. And yet now there is great change has come across the land. What caused that great change, do you think, John?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of ways you can answer that question, but I think the nation as a whole saw a couple of key things come up at once that contributed to the variety that we have now. One of them is that home brewing was made legal at some point. I think it was in the late 70s, right? Like 78. Charlie Papazian wrote a book about it, and people started trying to brew their own at home, which led the nation to see that there was definitely a quality and a character missing from what was on the Safeway shelves at the time. So people started experimenting, and then those people, some of them, started breweries.
Do you see the same thing happening in the world of wines?
Yeah, to a lesser extent. I mean, wine, there have always been regional producers that had a vineyard on their property that mm-hmm. were producing really high quality stuff that nobody really knew about because they didn't have the distribution. But, I mean, there are conglomerates in that world as well.
Well, good. Yeah, when we come back, I'd like to talk about the issue of distribution, and that seems to be really where the dividing line comes in between these giant organizations and then local beers and wines. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about beer and wine and local wines and beers as opposed to those giant corporations that seem to have at one time taken over the world, but their grips on our taste buds seem to be loosening a bit. We seem to be looking toward that localness in beer and wine and the character and the taste and the things that they can bring to our meals. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your join us with your questions about beer and wine. Right back. Well, what do you think? Do you think we need a king of beers? We certainly had one at one time, Budweiser. Then the Busch family sold its family beer to the InBev Corporation, and the InBev, being a giant multinational corporation, took over. And but something happened. All of a sudden, you look around the country and you see these craft beers springing up all over the place. Not only that, but people are actually learning how to brew their own beers, being taught by people like Amelia Loftus, who wrote a book called Sustainable Home Brewing. Amelia, I think the real big difference is transportation. When you have a real big brewery, you have to transport your beer all over the country. So things kind of get uniform. The bigger you get, the more uniform it gets. Whereas when you're brewing beer for a community, within a community, or for your family, things can get pretty unique, right?
That's absolutely true. And I think, you know, part of the whole trend of centralizing our food and beverage industry is seeing a backlash by smaller craft breweries and small food movements and growing farmers markets. And that whole scene is just, it's wonderful reintroduction to the variety of life, really.
To the spice of life.
To the spice of life. And home brewing is a great way to celebrate that. And, you know, looking at the whole thing from a sustainable aspect, decentralization and bringing more of the production into the local community makes a lot of sense. And you're lowering your carbon footprint by doing more of it locally, because transporting beer is transporting 95% water and glass or metal, depending on how the beer is packaged. By brewing it locally, you're just transporting the ingredients. And in some cases, when you can grow your own or source it from local growers, you're not even transporting those things that far.
So it's all very close. But now a discouraging word. I had an email from Molly who suggests that local beers and perhaps wines not such a good deal. I am beginning to suspect, she says, beer of being a toxic addition to the food system. Close friends have been made ill by homemade beer, and she goes on to say that I would not suggest that anyone drink beer expecting any health benefits, much less make homemade beer, which can be fatal if done improperly. And it's easy to make mistakes trying to do it properly. Wow.
Yeah, this is all coming from left field. I've never heard of anyone dying from drinking homebrew or craft beer. One of the reasons that beer became so popular during the Industrial Revolution is that the water wasn't safe to drink, and the water could kill you, but turning it into beer, and back then they would drink a fairly low alcohol beer so they could ingest a lot of liquid that way, because the alcohol fermentation made the beer safe to drink.
So it sterilized the water, allowing you to drink. And of course, that's what we drank throughout much of our history to survive. Couldn't drink the water, had to drink beer, had to drink wine, had to drink cider. Right. And you're making cider, John?
Yeah, we decided to try our hand at doing some cider this year from our friend's organic pippin apples that he grows in Corralitos.
So there you are. What's the difference between cider and like wine?
Well,
it's a fermentation,
cider,
right?
Yeah, you make cider on a winery license, not a brewery license, because it's a fruit product. And you can do cider in a lot of different ways. Being a winemaker, I'm treating it like a champagne. So it's been fermented and aged in neutral Chardonnay barrels. Actually, I saved my Chardonnay lees and put it in there as well. That's lees or spent yeast cells.
Uh-huh.
And trying to make a really light, kind of effervescent, kind of fun beverage that will absolutely kill you if you drink way too much of it and then fall off a cliff or something.
Fall off.
Like
there's
that.
The danger right there.
Other than that, no.
Let's go back to Molly's objection here to local stuff and the fear she expressed about, you know, if you do it improperly, you'll die, and it's easy to make mistakes trying to do it properly. And whenever I hear this, I think that it's one thing that fear is such a potent weapon, and it's often used to discourage us from taking care of ourselves, especially in the realm of food. We see where, you know, the federal government is instituting a whole new federal food police force to make certain that we're eating safe food. And you look at that and you wonder, well, how much does the king of beer have to do with spreading this notion that it's not safe to make our own beer? And I wonder. And so I look at and what kind of hoops must you go through to brew beer and brew and to ferment wine?
What, a lot.
A lot.
Commercially,
there are a lot, yeah. Also, you know, there is a pretty active beer lobby that's sort of buoyed by, you know, BMC, Bud Miller Coors,
mm-hmm.
to keep some of these old Prohibition-era laws or post-Prohibition-era laws in effect, like the three-tier thing for distribution that really kind of benefits.
What does that mean, three-tier thing?
Well, there's a three-tier system for distribution of beer and wine, all alcohol, but beer seems to be most affected by it because Bud Miller Coors have such a heavy hand in the wholesaler tier. There's a producer, wholesaler, and retail tier in the distribution of beer, and there are laws that don't allow a brewery to distribute their product outside their area directly to the consumer or the retailer.
Mm.
You have to go through the middleman, wholesaler.
Is there something like that with wine as well?
There is. Wineries like in California, we can self-distribute. That's state by state. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
Since, you know, most of the large majority of wineries in America are in California, it's not so much of an issue.
Okay,
for wine.
So then you can. But if you brew beer, if Amelia were to brew beer commercially and try to sell it to like the local convenience store, there would be a problem there.
She can regionally, right?
Regionally,
but not in Nevada.
Okay,
you can't send it to out of the state or anything like that.
So these laws were essentially developed when? Probably during Prohibition or something like that.
They came about as a protection after Prohibition ended, to keep the big beer companies from owning everything, from owning all of their own retail stores. But since then, you know, the little guy gets lost in that distribution tier because the big guys have the money to do all the marketing and promotions and paint the couch distributing trucks with
mm-hmm.
the Budweiser branding.
Logos.
You know, the little guys tend to get lost in that system, so it really does favor the big conglomerates.
Well, which of course is the way the laws usually work, right? We see a problem. For example, there is a contamination in spinach, so we pass laws governing how spinach may be grown and processed and sold, and who ends up usually benefiting from those laws are the very big producers of spinach, and the little producers of spinach who do not have the economies of scale sufficient to be able to afford to comply with all of those rules tend to get lost And it's kind of the same thing with beer and wine. There we go.
Very similar.
Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. What do you think? Do you think we need a king of beer out there? And do you drink that king of beer? I'd like to hear from somebody who still does drink that king of beer. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're talking about beer and wine. We're talking about local beer and wine in a world that has until very recently been dominated by the king of beers and the king of wines, and there are both. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back.
Frank Muller has been farming in Woodland with his brothers Louie and Tom for as long as they can remember.
We've been farming since we were kids, but the college years at UC Davis were the big years because what we learned there, we brought home. Today we're still working to make farming more productive and friendlier for the environment. Yeah, the future of agriculture looks good.
Find out how UC Davis partners with growers like the Mullers at onecalifornia.ucdavis.edu.
Well, what would it take for me, Michael Olson, to brew my own beer? Thought a lot about it because it seems like so much fun. Just to have a hand in brewing your own. Amelia, you wrote a book, Sustainable Home Brewing, and the book is like really thick. And I look at it and I go, oh my God, there's so much to it. But there really isn't to it. Too much can't be too much to it if you can put some bread into some water and get beer. It can't be that hard, can it?
And yeah, in a nutshell, it's a very simple concept. You're extracting sugars from grain and removing the grain part of it, so you just have liquid, and hops are added usually to balance the sweet of the sugars, and they act as a bit of a preservative.
A little bit of bitter?
A little bit of bitter as well, yep. Mm-hmm. And then you cool it down, add yeast, and the yeast converts the sugars into alcohol and other flavors, and
there, away you go.
In a short period of time, you have beer.
Sound about right, John?
Yeah.
I've had the opportunity to enjoy a lot of your home brew.
You know, I was 19 years old, I think, a UCSB student, and this is back in the Stone Ages, living in Isla Vista, and went down to some old guy's garage. He was like the one guy over 40 that lived in Isla Vista at the time. And he was selling all you needed to know and do and have to your own to make your own beer at home. And it consisted of a 5-gallon brew kettle, a very thin book with some basic recipes, some malt extract, some really bad bagged hops, and a glass carboy that I still have, actually, right now. It's holding some Pinot Noir topping wine.
So, not much equipment. Things you can pretty much do in your kitchen.
It's like $110 out the door, and home brewing my first beer, which we then, of course, we didn't drink it.
Of course,
we were
you're underage there in Isla Vista, and nobody in Isla Vista, UC Santa Barbara, drinks beer anyway.
But so it's perfectly legal to buy the ingredients. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's kind of another interesting thing. You know, probably kids have been drinking beer and wine for a long, long time. And you mentioned something earlier, whereas we used to drink a lot of low alcohol beers and wines kind of as a replacement for water. So you have control over those things then.
You definitely do. And it really depends on your taste, where you want to go with the hobby. You know, if you like the lighter, what we like to call lawnmower beers, you know, that's what you can brew. And those are great on a hot summer day where you're just thirsty and you want to enjoy the weekend afternoon and, you know, be able to quaff 3 or 4 beers, you know, then you definitely want a lighter alcohol level.
Those are kind of the 3-2 beers that we're accustomed to, the lagers, mm-hmm. the Coors and the Budweisers. That's what you generally get.
But the beauty of making your own is you don't have to, you know, add all those inputs that the big breweries use that they don't even legally have to put on the label. But there are many chemical inputs allowed in commercial beer that you know, don't make it onto the label.
For
and
example,
as a home brewer.
What do you mean by that?
Well, one that struck me when I saw the list the first time, and this was 10 years ago or something, was formaldehyde as a preservative allowed.
You're kidding.
No. Look it up.
They put formaldehyde in beer?
As a preservative, they want to have a long shelf life. But as a home brewer, you don't need to do any of that.
For formaldehyde?
For the woman concerned about the health problems related to brewing your own, we do not put formaldehyde in our home brews.
You don't put formaldehyde. How do you brew your own? So take us through the walk us through the process here.
Okay. Well, as an advanced home brewer, I brew from all grain. And so I briefly touched on that process where you introduce the malted grain to water.
So you soak the grain in water.
150 degree temperature. Let that steep for around an hour. And, you know, different recipes will have you, you know, adjust temperatures and water levels and time periods. But, you know, just in a rough average is an hour. And then you
so that's kind of on the stove or something if it's 150 degrees, right?
Or a lot of people will use an insulated container. I mean, if you have 5 gallons of liquid, it's going to hold its temperature pretty well for an hour, especially if you have some sort of insulation. So you can heat the water on a stove and then
put it in. Okay.
One of the neat things I've done, you know.
So you need a thermometer.
You need a thermometer. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, from a very simple standpoint, you could do this in a home kitchen doing 1 gallon batches with, you know, cookware that you already own, and all you would need to buy is a gallon glass jug and some, you know, special equipment to bottle. But you could be doing that for less than $50, even today at today's prices.
How long would it take to brew up a gallon of beer?
The cook time, if you're using extract, which is basically that process that I described done by a manufacturer, so you just add water and you already have your liquid that you can boil to make beer. In that case, it would take a couple hours.
Wow. So in a couple hours, you can make your own beer?
You would do the first stage. Then it needs to ferment, and that usually takes 2 weeks, depending on the style of beer that you're doing. But the cooking it up stage that requires hands-on, that can be done in a few hours. And then it sits somewhere for a couple of weeks, and then you have another hour or two to bottle, and that's it.
And there you are. And that's kind of the exciting part, right? Waiting for the 2 weeks to get finished doing their work so you can enjoy what you have done.
And it's fascinating to watch, you know, all the
bubbling.
And, you know, if you have it in a clear container, you can actually see it churning in there in the beginning.
It's life, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about brewing and distilling, and we're not distilling, but fermenting our own, with John Benedetti, Amelia Loftus, and you, 800-624-2665. Well, someone once said that eating is a political act. If such is indeed the case, is drinking a political act, John Benedetti?
Well, that's a loaded question.
So to speak.
Well, you know, you make your choices. The choices that you make with where you spend your money affect the community that you live in a huge way. And by choosing by knowing your brewer, that's a catchphrase one of my friends uses at his brewery. Know your brewer, because when you know your brewer, you know that you're shopping and thinking local with that money. And that is a very powerful political act, thinking local.
Thinking local. Amelia, author of Sustainable Home Brewing. Is sustainable home brewing a political act?
Absolutely. Choosing to brew your own beer rather than going out and buying Budweiser is huge. It's a statement that you want to take control over your beverage of choice and be involved in the process and bring it more to a local rather than centralized big business level.
Where do you see this going? Do you see the continuation of this? And if we do see a continuation of local home brewing and wine making, is this not a threat to some very powerful people who are going to start making laws against?
I think it's already, you know, the big brewing industry has seen it as a threat, both the craft, more in the craft brewing industry, because home brewers are such a minority that we just don't really hit the radar so much. But, you know, home brewers are very involved with the craft brew scene.
Now, do craft brewers grow out of home brewers, do you think?
In many cases, yes. And, you know, being involved with Seven Bridges over the years, and, you know, they also sell to local breweries. So mm-hmm. I attended many conferences and a couple of craft brewers conferences. And there's a huge nod to the home brewing community in the craft brew scene, where, you know, they recognize that some of the biggest breweries in the craft brewing scene are founded by home brewers.
Yeah,
and
we were home
John,
brewers.
That would be you, right?
That would be me, yeah. We were, my former partner worked at Seven Bridges, and we met there.
What is Seven Bridges?
Seven Bridges is a local homebrew supply store. So, it's all organic as well. Mm-hmm. Answering your question about what are the big guys going to do, a lot of what they're doing now is not necessarily revolving around passing laws to get the little guy out. They've focused a lot of energy in acquisitions. So you look at breweries like 10 Barrel in Bend, which is was a very good brewery. And Anheuser-Busch just bought them for a very large sum of money. They're acquiring the little mm-hmm. guys now to try and consolidate that world. Fortunately, there seems to be a really healthy cynicism uh-huh. and skepticism among beer geeks out there. That's, I guess I can say fortunately. It's not necessarily fortunate, because 10 Barrel may still remain, breweries like that may remain very good after the transition, but people are suspicious.
So the home brewers brew up some great beer. Their neighbors taste it and go, oh, this is so good. The home brewer thinks, well, maybe I can do this for a living. Builds up a brewery, gets something going. Wow, people from all over think this is great stuff. InBev comes in, buys them, and there you go. You have the cycle complete. Folks, this has been the Food Chain Radio program. I want to thank you all for tuning in out there. I want to thank John Benedetti. What's the name of your wine?
Sante Arcangeli Family Wines.
There you go. Amelia Loftus, author of Sustainable Home Brewing. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you all out there for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.